Howdy, guys. Great to be here with all of you. This is the Happy Warrior Podcast. This is my coronavirus special. In this episode, I sit down with my friend Professor Wilfred Riley from Kentucky State University. He's an author and a historian. He works on the 1776 Project. He's written Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. One of the smartest guys I know, really. And so in this episode, we sit down and we shoot the breeze and talk about the coronavirus. How is it impacting us? What are the facts and myths surrounding this? What are the real likelihood of you getting sick or seeing a problem? And what does this really mean for governments across the world? We talk about what the Chinese are doing and how the media seems to be carrying water for Chinese propaganda, which is just ridiculous. If there are any ideas or thoughts you might have had about coronavirus but we're too afraid to ask, we try to cover it here. You guys have been just so wonderful to me. I really hope you enjoy this interview with Professor Wilfred Riley and our coronavirus special.
The Happy Warrior Podcast, conservative commentary on the news of the day from a more positive perspective.
With you, I have with me today Professor Wilfred Riley. We've had him here on before about a month ago to talk about his book.
It's just Taboo. Let's see if I have a copy. Yeah, it's Taboo, the 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. I guess we've given them here to colleagues and so on. I do have the previous book, Hate Crime Hoax.
Hate Crime Hoax. I also read that one. That one was also pretty good. So let's get this thing started. How are you doing today, Professor?
I'm doing pretty well. Like, essentially everyone I know, I'm healthy. Doing the standard stuff. I mean, we're all at work. I mean, it's a major university, but we're fairly socially distanced. People are 10 or 12 feet apart, you know, office doors open is an option, you know, but there's really not a whole lot going on. I mean, in day-to-day life in a provincial city, we're not seeing too many changes. For health reasons, most of the restaurants are operating on a carry-out basis and so on, which does make sense, but that's the kind of thing you're dealing with.
You teach at a college. Like, has your personal life changed? Are you teaching from home? Are you still going to the campus?
Well, we have a hard opening date of April 13th, and I think really what we're doing with a lot of this, I mean, it verges on panicking, but the legitimate health preparations under that is really getting ready for the end of spring flu season and for some health impacts that are going to happen, I'd say, in the USA. So we're trying to store up more ventilators and so on while people are distancing. That's pretty much what we're doing here. I mean, construction staffers and so on have been moving sanitizing stations and that kind of thing onto the campus. A lot of our, mostly, although not entirely, male faculty and staff have been helping with that sort of thing. We cleared out of our offices while some things were done. People are carrying stuff around. People, I mean, I have, you know, Lysol wipes and all that in the office. I mean, one of the very few ways you could give a disease to someone without direct within 2 feet contact is, for example, coughing all over things and then leaving them laying around. So we're wiping down. But again, in practical, I believe there are 22 cases of known symptomatic COVID-19 in Kentucky. So people are using, let's say, an abundance of caution. There is no one has died that I know intimately or anything like this. I think there's been one death in the state. But we are getting ready. When we do open, I mean, the faculty members will be behind a specific podium, I believe. You're not going to be encouraged to walk around and sit on desks and so on. Students will be a bit further apart. Many students are opting to e-learn from home. So all our classes have migrated online for about, I mean, that 1 to 2 month period. I, in general, make an online option available anyway, in case someone is, for example, a law enforcement officer, a Leo, and they want to take a criminal justice class. The assignments will all be visible online. The discussion boards will all be online. So we're having people engage online. And I mean, you're having the enjoyable task of keeping track of 100 19-year-old kids via computer. You know, what is attendance for that day and so on. But it's, I mean, obviously manageable.
That's good to hear. It sounds like you guys are kind of going with like the middle road choice. So me personally, I'm social distancing, but I'm a disabled guy. I social distance all the time. This is just my normal. A little bit of schadenfreude watching everyone freak out about being stuck at home. You know, I have a brother who's at college right now at Brigham Young University, and they pretty much just shuttered. They said unless you have a physical lab, that you're there, they went to all online classes. My church has gone pretty hard and fast on the social distancing. They canceled all churches. Most of our temples are closed, that kind of thing. Interesting how people are dealing with it. In my home state, we have the total of 14 cases as of this morning. And I think one death.
Yeah. Can I say one thing about that?
Yeah.
Well, actually, this gets into, I mean, if I had one sentence to say about COVID-19, it would be, this is serious. We need to definitely protect people that are immunosuppressed or that are seniors, but it's not the plague. And that the average person, by which I just mean the guy at the median, quote unquote, able-bodied, is at a very, very, very low risk of death. So you have to balance those two things. You don't want anyone sacrificed or hurt. But at the same time, I mean, doing some calculation models today, the average person, again, just guy at the median's risk of death from COVID-19 is about 1 in 1,000. If you cut, assuming a 1% mortality rate, which probably is not the case, kind of steel manning it there, but at a 1 in 10 chance, fully half, a tenth of the population contracts the disease, it's 3/4 as large as swine flu ever was. In that scenario, your chance of death would be 1 in 1,000. So you do have to balance protecting those that are vulnerable. For example, like virtually everyone I know here in the South, I'm shopping for elderly neighbors, one, with avoiding absolute panic, two. If there's a plant in town with run by 12 men that makes airplane parts, that can probably stay open. And in KY, we've seen the governor say things like that or give orders like that. So you do have to have a bit of a balance. If I did something like play basketball with a group of 5 guys, I probably wouldn't. I'm a bit of a germaphobe. It seems like a stupid macho thing to do. But there's very little risk associated with that as opposed to me then going with those guys to visit someone's grandmother. I mean, so there is a balancing of risk that goes on when you think about something like this.
It's hard because it seems to be framed as either you just think this is being underplayed and there's no risk at all, or you feel like, you know, it's the Walking Dead is about to take place. I think it's
that's
like,
well put, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's like, it's a nuance, right? So it's not your college students that are at risk of getting hurt, really. It's, I mean, they might get sick, but the likelihood of them surviving is pretty high. But it's your college students, they get sick and then they pass it on to grandma or they pass it to someone that is immunosuppressed. But I kind of want to say, and maybe because you deal with 19-year-olds, you saw all these stories like at Miami Beach.
Oh, yeah.
All these millennials that are they're just like, I get it, and just out partying. I think the Florida governor had announced they closed all the bars. They're like, we're closing all the bars. All of you have to leave. Get out of our state.
Yeah, that's an example. I mean, that is pretty stupid. Again, though, I will say it's stupid to me because it's callous as regards other people. If you actually – I have some friends that work for organizations like the WHO, and I've been a World Meters user for – years. I mean, World Meters coronavirus is really good. But if you look at actual death rates by group, like in a Chinese slum, if we're being blunt, I mean, the portion of Wuhan that was heavily quarantined, the death rate for healthy, non-immunosuppressed individuals under 50 was 0.25% if they got the disease. So in that nightmare 1 in 10 scenario where you have to say, I have coronavirus, I think a lot of people are under the impression that they're going to die. Like when I listen to upper middle class female friends or ex-girlfriends talk, it's like, can I walk the dog? Things that don't even involve other people. Look, you should be very, very careful around seniors. But yes, you can go outside. If you used to be a distance runner, go run. The chance of death in a 1 in 10 infection scenario would be 1 in 400 if you're under 50. The original 1 in 1,000 figure I gave for general population would be 1 in 400 times 1 in 10 if you're healthy and under 50. That's the data from Wuhan. I can make it, myself and Peter both get contacts after these sort of videos. I can make that available if anyone needs it. So that is the one side. The other side is that in Wuhan, the death rate for individuals over 80 was 15%. So when we see these high death figures, that's because there's one group of people, super seniors, people with respiratory illnesses that very likely will die if they get coronavirus. Yeah. I mean, one thing that I'm doing, just two quick comments and I'll shut up, but What we probably should be doing is quarantining seniors. The reason we're not doing this is that the average age of the people running for president is like 77.
Yeah, they're all septuagenarians now.
Yeah, and they're all saying, no, Trump and Bernie are out there like flexing their muscles. Both of them have done that, literally talking about how healthy they are. That's dumb. But seniors in general should be very receptive to at least self-quarantining. You should expect younger individuals or your family to take that slight risk. If there's any family coherence at all, bring groceries and so on in. That would eliminate 90% of the death risk here. One of the few rules I have with coronavirus, they're actually only, well, I mean, I guess they're four or five. One is social distancing, clean your hands, don't be rude, give people 5 or 6 feet. Another is be very careful with seniors. And I guess the third is I would avoid a gathering of more than, say, 10 people just based on stochastic odds, 10x, 10x, 10. But if you're a normally healthy person, those three rules, be very careful with seniors, social distance or within reason, and avoid parties, which is just obnoxious anyway at the moment. Those will probably keep you quite safe. That'll increase your 1 in 10 chance of contracting, perhaps 1 in 100, and you're talking about 1 in 400 over here.
Yeah, there's so many bugs. You know, we're still coming out of the winter. You know, we have flu, that's still around. You have all this crud and cough, sinus infection. All this stuff is still around. I have to agree with you that it is a bit overhyped. I understand the prevention and why we do it, and that's smart and all good. But I am a little bit annoyed at the bit of the freak out. But I mean, we're only like, this is what, day 5 of social distancing? Have you seen the video of the Thailand monkeys? I just posted
this on
my Twitter.
Yeah, they're fighting in the street.
Yeah, they're just going crazy each other. I'm just like, day 45 of social distancing. That's what's going to be looking like in America.
Well, I also will say, I mean, if you're over 30 to 35, I mean, I think, first of all, I do think, again, I'm going to keep emphasizing, you have a 1 in 400 chance of dying of something you have a 1 in 10 chance of catching. Calm down, shop for your elderly neighbors. But with that said, I also think that there's a bit of a frenzy on the right about how restrictive social distancing is. I mean, so
yeah,
like,
no, that does seem fair. Yes.
New York and California, very specifically, do have pretty restrictive standards in place. You could question those. But in terms of virtually every other state, like Philadelphia, that's just encouraging strong social distancing, what they're saying, like the list of approved businesses is extremely broad. It includes automobile parts stores, post offices, laundromats, cannabis dispensaries. I mean, I think that the ordinary person, grocery stores, will be able to live pretty much the ordinary life that they would lead without the partying component.
As someone with a journalism background, I just get annoyed when things are one way or not. I think it's also as much as a political thing. I think it's also because red states are just less densely populated, putting aside maybe like Florida. We don't have as many as big blue cities. Blue culture, the Democrats, they live in these big cities, you know, like New York, and they're much closer together. So it could be also a cultural thing. What do you think of the government response so far to the COVID-19 situation?
So first of all, I think that this is a situation where there is a pretty definite, pretty clear response, which would be quarantining those people that actually are at risk of the disease. That, I think, probably would have been the ideal solution. And that's what Britain has decided to do once their herd immunity thing began to be pretty broadly questioned, which was just, we're going to let people go to soccer games and see if they get sick.
Yeah,
and even I,
that,
coming
that
from sort of a macho perspective.
Yeah, that wasn't a very bright move.
I don't think that was the smartest thing that's ever been done. But their position right now is essentially, we're going to keep small local pubs open. We're going to keep businesses open, many schools open. What we're going to do is strongly encourage, through the risk of fines and things like that, seniors, individuals who are over 70, to stay home. And we're going to provide things like food delivery to the homes of individuals who are immunosuppressed. We're going to do that. That's going to be our focus. And we think that will stop 90% of potential deaths. And I have to say that's probably the most effective, most targeted approach, where you really surround vulnerable elders, for many of them for the first time in years probably, with a network of people that would bring food and clean water and that kind of thing. Our government has decided to take another approach, which is very comprehensive restriction of society for most people. That can work. I think you're going to see fewer COVID-19 deaths because of that than you otherwise would have. The one point that I would make with that is that there really has to be a plan in place. There has to be an end date on it. So you have to, hopefully the government is using this time to set up testing stations. They're using this time to build up the supply of ventilators, respirators, so on down the line. Hospital beds. And that remains to be seen. I mean, right now, I'd give them about a B minus. There seems to be a fair amount of internal partisan quarreling. And again, I don't think this is necessarily the most effective solution, but I think it's better than nothing. What do you think?
So there's obviously a temptation. I was a Democrat and I was advising them. I would probably do what they're saying and try to make the falling of the economy and the COVID situation, try to turn that into a way to win November, which seems like smart politics, even if it's not necessarily great for our political dialogue. Look, I think the number one problem of this, and we can talk about this a little bit with China, okay, is just there's a lack of data. That's been the problem of this from the very beginning is – there's just not any data. So it's even hard to tell. You did risk assessment, but at the beginning of this, it felt like, okay, so is this going to be Spanish flu and it's 1.5 million people are going to die because of this? Or is it going to be, you know, like normal flu or twice that? And maybe you have, you know, 150, 250,000 or much less. We just don't know. And I think that the government's response often feels like when they're acting to me, they're like, we don't know either. And that doesn't seem like – that doesn't seem to reassure people very much. So right now everyone is social distancing and some people are spreading on social media, though there's not – I don't know how to start saying this could be a year and a half. And I'm like, I don't know if I could do 18 months.
That's not
accurate though. But I mean that we are doing the social distancing and we don't actually know – we don't actually have a concrete date. Okay, guys, you only have to keep the kids at home and homeschool for 3 months. Or you only have to, some. I think there was a governor who was saying, well, yeah, we're going to do this like a month, 2 months. And then, you know, we might come back a couple months later, might do it again. Maybe. I don't know. They're just like, oh my gosh. It's painful to watch. Maybe that's my Midwestern background, but I just want concrete answers. I don't, I need to be soothed and calm my fears.
Had it a little bit.
Yeah. You need me to make. I need the president to make me feel better.
So can I actually kind of give some estimates there and talk about some of the figures?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. So this to me is the most important element of the whole debate. And although I think most people appreciate this, whether you're talking about pretty significant political figures or buddies of mine on Facebook, I've also been criticized for kind of not fear mongering enough. I.e., the idea is we need to overreact. We need to assume the highest possible death rates, etc. I don't think that's a very logical model. So like the first thing that's notable about COVID-19 is, yeah, we have no idea what the death rate from the disease actually is. Like your comment there was extraordinarily insightful. Like when we look even at a site like World Meters, yes, which is where I came up with my 1 in 1,000 figure, what we're seeing, and you need to understand this, it's hard to get a COVID-19 test. What we're seeing on World Meters is the death rate for people that felt sick, they're all symptomatic, and that were scared enough about it to contact a hospital, and that then went through about a 12-question quiz, which includes, are you almost certain you interacted with someone who had COVID-19 to get in to take the test, and then took the test and tested positive? That's an extraordinarily high-risk group. I mean, that's a group that I would estimate is, in age terms, 20 or 30 years ahead of the rest of the population. So when you see a 1.5% death rate, you're seeing it for that group. One of the things that's kind of the elephant in the room is that millions of people almost certainly have COVID-19. This has come up over and over again. The governor of Ohio said, and they used some pretty solid methodology to get this estimate, that there must be at least 100,000 Ohioans, when you factor in spring break and so on, that have the disease. And what that implies, because there's been essentially no increase that I'm familiar with, in, for example, rates of seasonal flu death, what that implies is that almost all of those people have asymptomatic or very mild cases, and none of them, or perhaps one in a thousand of them, died. Otherwise, you'd see a significant uptick in death rates. I mean, if you're talking about a 10% or even a 1% death rate from a disease that's infected 50 to 100,000 people per state, you would see quite a few people passing away. That's not what you see. So in all likelihood, if you gave legitimate testing to a large chunk of the population, you'd find that something like one person in 80 had COVID-19, and you'd find that the death rate was something like 0.2% or 0.4%. And I'm not just pulling that out of, let's be more elegant than saying, my ass, thin air. I'm actually extrapolating from South Korea. The South Koreans gave tests to a very large chunk of the population, and even those were people that wanted the test enough to queue up for hours, first of all. But they gave a pretty randomly selected chunk of people the COVID-19 test. Their death rate has very consistently by region been between 0.4% and 1%. It's never been higher. So you're probably looking at something, I would guess, like half of 1%, maybe, if you actually just tested everybody. You're not actually looking, in my opinion, at 3 or 4%. There's a great article on this on the Stata website, or the stats website, called A Fiasco in the Making. The subtitle, As the Coronavirus Panic Spreads, We're Making Decisions Without Reliable Data. A Fiasco in the Making, As the Coronavirus Panic or Pandemic, may have misread, spreads, We're Making Decisions Without Reliable Data. And what makes the author of this piece probably worth listening to is that he's the guy who did most of the study of the people that were stuck on the Golden Princess cruise ship. That's the one population where you've had a substantial number of people just exposed to COVID-19 that couldn't get away from it. And you find those 10 to 20% infection rates that I've been citing and that people have been using. Not everyone gets the disease. But you also find that only 1% of the people that got the disease died. And that's notable because cruise ship populations trend old. This was a very old, upper middle class group of people. So what the guy who wrote this article says is that if you apply that same curve to our actual population, the COVID-19 death rate would be 0.125%. I'm not quite prepared to go that far, but that's probably something like what we're talking about, as opposed or that up to 0.5%, 0.7% in Korea. But you're not actually talking about millions of people dying. I would say that if 10% of the population contracted COVID-19 and the death rate was 0.5%, the max worst case scenario would be 160,000 people dying. That's terrible. But to put that in context, there are about 55 to 70,000 flu deaths every flu season.
Yep.
Also, I think that we're taking substantially more measures to prevent COVID-19 than we do with flu. Very substantially more. Massive social distancing, a quarantine of seniors, all of those things would suffice to dramatically limit the toll of people that could be lost.
Like, worst case, say we're Wuhan, China, where this thing likely originated. I mean, I think they had 1.2, maybe. Yeah, again, it's serious. I mean, it reminds me of the SARS. I think there was like 200-something thousand hospitalizations from the SARS epidemic during the Obama administration. So, I mean, a lot of these things happen, and we normally don't know anything about it and don't do much. What Trump has done, I think, and the government, I think overall is probably good and wise. I think perhaps if this was an election year and the hype had kind of been built up, we wouldn't take this as seriously. No, I'm not saying it's not a serious problem. I just think
they're not going to ban you.
I think where it sits in the culture, I think, is a lot of it has to do with politics and the ramp up. It's not to call it like The Walking Dead, but it reminds me of The Walking Dead because it has this cultural buildup, this anticipation for it. And when you actually get the disease, for most people that get it, it's not much worse than a bad respiratory infection.
Yeah, you don't turn into a zombie.
That'd be kind of cool, actually.
Brains, you know, stumbling. I mean, yeah, that would be entertaining at least. But no, I mean, I think that your first point there, that this is not the first epidemic of this kind, I think there are two points there. One, no, it's not. I mean, you also had the swine flu epidemic under President Obama, which was very, very similar to this. I mean, it was an epidemic new strain of flu. As I recall, it came from a friendly but rivalrous foreign power, perhaps China. Some people argued Mexico. It infected 40 million people. It killed more than 12,000 people, I believe closer to 15,000. So again, you're looking at a fatality rate of perhaps 0.3%. I mean, very, very similar. I think that one thing that made a big difference is that social media didn't exist then. Quite honestly.
No, nothing like it is now. No.
Yeah. I mean, well, of course, there's Facebook if you were in college.
I think Facebook did exist in 2009, 2010 when swine flu was happening.
Yeah, you still had MySpace, also the last years of MySpace. Yeah. Those were the days. But in all reality, though, there's not necessarily all that much difference between a pathogenic extreme form of flu, super flu, you could call it, that kills almost 15,000 people, infects 40 million people, causes political crisis, than what we're seeing now. I think that the major factor variables that are different are the presence of an almost pathologically aggressive president. We're going to respond. And in the presence of another party that despises him and that's going to attempt to use this politically. And then three, the presence of social media. So what you've seen is a highly politicized healthcare situation, which is not ideal. But I mean, I would bet that to some extent, virtually every state shutting down is a heavily blue state politically. And then, I mean, you pointed this out empirically, you get into the question of, are there just more people in blue states as well? So, I mean, there are questions that you can ask, but those variables definitely played a role. Those aren't just accidents of history. I also will say we seem to have moved more toward panics in the social media era. Just a month before this, remember that the world was going to end? I don't mean to compare the two, but I mean like
you
Greta
have to
Thunberg.
Remind me, what was it going to end from?
Climate disaster. Remember Guardian front page headline: global climate catastrophe.
Yeah, I remember.
Greta was at Davos. I mean, as I recall, because no one is saying this anymore because it was just bullshit. Excuse the language, but as I recall, we had 12 years to live. In 12 years, the most extreme of the climate model showed that we would break through the cap or the line or whatever, and we would. The Earth would no longer be sustainable. It would no longer be possible to rein in global climate change. Now, again, these models have problems because they're put together by humans. And unlike the gods, humans are imperfect by definition. So, for example, that model assumed that we wouldn't develop technology any further after the year 2016 or whatever was constructed. Who knows what our carbon capture technology will look like in 2037? So there's an element of nonsense to these predictions. But immediately before we heard the prediction that coronavirus will kill millions, we heard the prediction that the world will end in 12 years. As you said, don't want to get kicked off YouTube or spread BS. I'm not comparing those two. But this has gone on for a while. Remember Black Lives Matter, the predictions of a race war in the USA? Police are murdering tens of thousands of innocent black people.
Yeah, Andrew Yang, he also posited that one out. I remember that.
Yeah, but I mean, the phrase used was tens of thousands. I and Heather McDonald looked at this for pretty serious books. That total number of unarmed black men murdered by white cops was 17 the year I looked at. I mean, so these panics, these cyclical panics seem to be coming more and more frequently now as the news cycle tightens, as you get more players in big news, and as you get more social media.
I agree, not to get too John Stossel, but I mean, risk assessment, people. I mean, millions of people die every year from cancer. It's like...
Oh, yeah.
500,000 die from smoking. Car accidents, I think, is like 30 or 40,000. I mean, these numbers are bad, but you got to put them in context with what risks are most likely to kill you. So let's move on to my favorite. This is the one I get excited for. I'm a bit of a China watcher, though. I'm not great at it. There are much, much better people who keep an eye on what happens on China. But what do you think of the new... And I'm not surprised. I'm disappointed that U.S. journalists and the left here in the United States have been pushing this idea from the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, that if you call the coronavirus Chinese or you say this thing originated from China, ergo, it is racist and you should not say it. You're a bad person.
This is just one of these idiotic social justice controversies that is disturbing, although it is not apocalyptic. Watch your grandmother. Social controversy that we're dealing with. This social justice nonsense is doing nothing positive during a time of conflict for the country. So to get into this a little bit, first of all, a lot of the things that are being said, like the idea that the coronavirus might not have originated in China, that's usually how it's phrased, or the claim that the use of the term Wuhan virus, because no one says Chinese Communist Party virus. The use of the term Wuhan virus is racist. Much of that comes directly from the CCP in China. For those of you that are on Twitter, you should be very aware that Xinhua News, X-I-N-H-U-A, is the official Chinese Communist Party propaganda outlet. So whenever I see people retweet and say, well, they have a different perspective on this, yes, because that's the actual Chi-Com party. Yes. You fool. That's what being
Global
a useful...
Times is another one. Yep.
Yes. That's what being a useful idiot is. When you see something from the Chinese communists and you say, well, in its way, that's just as valid as something from the Washington Post. No, it's not. Fox may lean a bit right. The Post may lean a bit left. But we have independent, privately owned news in the USA. That's not a concept in China. China has its own Twitter, Sina Weibo. So they don't have to face the peril of free exchange. Sina Weibo is an Orwellian nightmare. It's monitored by allegedly about 2 million people who scroll through every 30 seconds for the phrases representing pornography, political freedom movement, so on. So that is communist China. As for the broader question of whether it's racist to name diseases after their home province, that's actually an interesting one. The World Health Organization said in 2015 that it's quote unquote not ideal. So that is a thing. There's a history of diseases being mislabeled, like the Spanish flu, for example, was associated for a while with, you know, the dirty conditions of those Latin lovers over there. And it turned out that the Spanish flu actually was a universal battlefield condition during World War I. It was extraordinarily common. It probably should have been called the Prussian flu. The reason it became known as Spanish was simply that Spain was a neutral country. So they were reporting honestly, many of our visitors from North America, Germany, whatever, seemed to be sick. And that was twisted as well. They're getting sick there. So because of things like that, you're encouraged not to name diseases after countries. On the other hand, the WHO has no legal power whatsoever in the USA, and it happens all the time. I mean, in fact, we still say Spanish flu. MERS is Middle Eastern Upper Respiratory Syndrome. I mean, that's got to be less than 15 years old. Lyme disease comes from a town in Pennsylvania. So this is almost universally ignored. There is that directive there. No, it's not racist to say it is a Chinese virus. But nothing that SJWs call racist actually is.
Look, even if China isn't the originator of the virus, and it's highly, highly probable that they are. Loads of things that have become pandemics or quasi-pandemics have come from China because of the wet market system they have there, where they take all these animals from all over the world and they just cram them in these little cages all right next to each other. And it's just terrible conditions for the animals, terrible conditions for the people, let alone the animals. I would also say that China deserves it for what they did, because China was the first country that got this, and that they took the guy that discovered this, Dr. Li Wenliang, and he mysteriously passed away a month later after
he
disappeared. I have no proof to say that they disappeared him and they censored him, they actually did something or not. But I mean, he was a healthy 30 something. It's not impossible if you're in the 30s and you're healthy that you could die from corona. It's just, you know, again, unlikely. And
Figured out empirically there's a 1 in 4,000 risk he wasn't killed by the Chinese or whatever it was. I mean, the other element seems more likely to me.
So that's November when this is first being shown up. Dr. Li talks about in December. The China says, shut up, shut up, shut up. They shut them up. The WHO, which would normally at that point get involved, the China uses its power because the WHO, the World Health Organization, is tied to the United Nations. And because the United Nations is made up of all the many countries, China has done this really interesting thing is they have the Belt and Roads Initiative. So the little countries then are dependent on China, either financially directly through loans to build a port or whatever, or because China's actually built their roads and their ports and are helping them mine their stuff, and that's complicated. So China said, okay, all you little countries, all of you, tell the WHO to knock it off and not talk about it. So the WHO then shuts up, and then it's almost at the end of January, and this thing's now in Europe. This is on China, like the Chinese Communist Party specifically, but China, this is their fault. If you're going to put blame to someone, if you're going to put blame to some thing, logically speaking, historically speaking, putting aside any concerns of how Chinese Americans may be perceived after this, and I just don't think Americans are all that racist that they would actually make that connection. But okay, fine. It is China's fault by every other way. If the United States did this kind of stuff to the rest of the world, you could rightly say that we made it impossible for them to do their job to get on top of this.
The idea that the virus didn't begin in China is completely nonsensical. I mean, we saw the first reports from Wuhan. All the initial whistleblowers were Chinese. Google Earth is a thing that exists. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt about this. It was referred to on CNN and MSNBC as Wuhan virus for months until they got the woke memo and decided this couldn't be done anymore. So this is just one of these, again, social justice redefinitions that ignore the real issue. The real issue is that several million people globally, although this probably won't happen, could die of the virus. An unreal, insincere side issue is, are the Chinese responsible? Of course the Chinese are responsible. I will say the government actually did take the step of banning wet markets. No more bushmeat, the law is sort of jokingly known as. So you're not supposed to sell wild animals, have living wild animals.
Yeah, we'll see how well they can enforce that. I'll believe it when I see it. The SJWs are on the wrong side of this China thing. Look. If you're watching this,
almost every issue.
Social justice warriors, but listen to me, guys. You like animals? China is the worst environmental polluter in the world. They don't even pollute their own country. They go to the South America and Africa, pollute there too. Global warming, they are burning coal plants and they're creating cement and making steel like nobody else's business. I mean, you name the issue that you're worried about, and they are on the wrong side. Human rights abuses. I could go. I'm sorry. I am getting back on the stand. But
locking up a million Muslim citizens in a prison camp carved out of a mountain.
Yeah, locking up at least 1 million Uyghurs, could be as many as five. There is a report from the Associated Press that said based on satellite maps, what they thought actually were other detention camps or education camps, whatever they like to call them. I just they're so wrong on this. They should get on this side, but because we're all America, we may be the wealthiest nation on earth, but sometimes I think we're the dumbest. We're like, well, because we don't like that guy over there, and it's our turn to not like him, you know, because we're the party of our power, so our culture doesn't like him, and we could play about. Ergo, we are going to ignore the human rights abuses of country X, and it's just crazy. It's crazy. If this was World War II and we were doing this, well, those Yahtzees over there in Germany, they may be killing those people, but you know what? You can't talk about that. Because to do so would make you you're anti-German, you're anti-white. I know that doesn't fit under intersectionality rules, but you get what I'm saying.
It's worth noting the left actually did this. I mean, to a certain extent, when we were fighting the National Socialists, and definitely when we were fighting the communists during the Cold War. I mean, this was very, very. Americans were painted as the bad guy in these famous scientific articles, scorpions in a jar, apes on a treadmill, much less in the popular press. The majority viewpoint was probably that we were the bad folks. So, I mean, this sort of fourth column in the media and the intelligentsia has been a problem in the USA for a while. And I mean, there's an old line, the average man's natural gait is a goose step. That argues that it's a problem in all democracies, that there are people in democracies that want to live in a pretend utopia where they don't have to make the decisions anymore. So there's a lot of sympathy for communism on the left. There's a lot of sympathy for monarchy on the right. In reality, neither works as well as our system. But I mean, I believe it was Whitaker Chambers wrote the conservative classic Witness, 1958, where he said, I was a communist. I was the editor of Time magazine, and I was a communist. I'm telling you this now because I am no longer a communist. But there are hundreds of communists in positions of power in the USA. And this was absolutely accurate. I mean, this book is one of the 100 classics of the past century. And that's what launched the quote-unquote Red Scare. But as that name itself indicates, there was an effort made very early on to paint this as a bunch of heartland, stupid rubes that thought that anyone they didn't like was a communist, that were racist. And a lot of the people involved in that, like Bill Buckley, just kept saying, no, I'm not a racist. I just mean you guys are communists. And it turned out that was in many cases correct. And I suspect the same thing is going on here, that you do see actual retweeting of, for example, points directly from the Chi-Coms. And the idea is just, well, at least this is an alternative to, you know, our racist, corrupt, banal society where my dad was never around. You know, so I'm not very sympathetic toward this, but you recognize it. It's been going on for a while.
One positive thing to come out of the coronavirus, even if we do see The Walking Dead, if this is the start. I'm ready for it, man. I love that series. I've been getting ready for The Walking Dead for a long time. So my brother too. We got our kits. We did Boy Scouts, so we know how to make fires. We're ready for this. But even if
you have like guns that shoot knives and stuff.
That's right. The Walking Dead, the newest season, they now have these giant shields with spikes. I need to get me one of those. But even if it goes bad that way, friend of mine. General Robert Spalding wrote a book, Stealth War, and he was on the podcast back in November. He has been struggling like heck. Even when he was up there at the Pentagon and he was part of the National Council, he was having just a heck of a time to get anyone to listen about China's atrocities. You name it on anything, either it's economic, if it's what they do to their own people, the wet markets, the animals, whatever. And they acknowledge, like intellectually, they understood, but like, I don't really care. I mean, I got some stock there. And now I'm seeing people all of a sudden be like, no, China is a bad player, guys. We got to take this seriously. If anything positive comes out of this is that more people wake up. And I don't know. People in the West have an amazing ability to wake up to something and then to go back to sleep. So I try not to get my hopes up too high. But that could be the positive in all this.
But yeah, I definitely think if we're not being immediately provoked by outside powers, there's a tendency here to sit on an ass, make money in the market, drink scotch whiskey, do very little. A Muslim friend of mine, a Muslim Arab friend of mine, described this as jahiliya, which means essentially sort of soft barbarism. If you don't have a hard religious tradition, if you don't have just one dominant racial group with a very strong identity, if you're a bunch of tradespeople that like and enjoy each other but spend a lot of time competing, you have a tendency toward weakness and lassitude. You're all free. You all have more potential than anyone in any other society, but day to day, do you use it? The question is, will this provoke us enough to actually respond to China? I mean, we're certainly not going to fight a war with China.
No, obviously. The likelihood, they don't want a military conflict any more than anyone else. So, I mean, they make a big face of it, and they invest a ton in their military. But, I mean, the likelihood of an actual armed conflict is so incredibly unlikely. It's not impossible. It's just we're so tight at the hip economically that to do so would be a nuclear – it would be the nuclear equivalent of an economic bomb.
And also the nuclear equivalent of a nuclear bomb, both countries being
heavily armed. That's right.
But, I mean – no, I think that one question here, and I'm not an economist, just like, I mean, I'm discussing like statistical likelihoods of disease transmission. I'm not discussing vector paths because I'm not an epidemiologist. I don't want to just BS. Similarly, I'm not an economist. I don't know how plausible this is. But I mean, it would be interesting to see if there's some possibility of taking coronavirus damages out of the debt we owe China. I mean, a fair amount of that is not T-bills. A fair amount of that is promises to pay. I mean, what's to stop us from saying no? Your pandemic toppled our economy. It cost us $5 trillion. No. Is that something we'd consider? I don't know. Unfortunately, you're still seeing these kind of ruling class, we would never do that, shenanigans. Even as the virus crisis / panic hits. I mean, so there were these congressmen. Did you follow this? These senators?
Yeah, this just came out last night. Yeah, insider trading. Both Democrats and Republicans. We know of at least four of them. We know of at least four. Inhofe, Dianne Feinstein. I can't remember. There are two more. Sorry, I'm really bad at remembering names.
It's up to six now, but I don't remember more than another one of them.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's a lot more than six.
But I mean, this was a situation where they were told the country's probably going to enter a pandemic, but we're likely to enter a pandemic. And they left the meeting. They lied to the American people about the likelihood of a pandemic and they dumped all their stock. Even beyond this, you wonder why that was the route they took. I would strongly recommend, although this is an investment advice, that people invest in the market. I went online today using Robinhood and E-Trade. And I mean, I bought Wendy's for $8 a share. I mean, Nike was $60 a share, you know, Planet Fitness, $26 a share. So, I mean, unless you think we're going to totally go belly up and everyone's going to die, this is a great time to buy into American companies.
I'll end it here with this cute, this little story. So back in the day when I was a teenager and I was in Boy Scouts, there was, I forget what the badge was, but it had to deal with finance. And part of the thing was, okay, you go with the, your troop goes over a three-month period of investing money in stocks. So, I mean, the real stocks, but it's fictional money.
All right.
And whoever, the guy, he said, whoever has the biggest change wins the contest. And I won the contest. But not because of my incredible investment advice. I had lost more than anyone else in the group had gained. So I have ever since been a little nervous providing stock advice.
What did you buy?
I invested what I thought was Nintendo. I had no idea what I was doing. I had zero idea what I was doing. But hey, I did.
And it was like NIN, the doomed alternative music label or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Something like it was Napster, or
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Hey, thank you so much. This was fun, Professor Riley. This is exactly what I was hoping for. Thank you so much. Thank you for doing your research. You came very well prepared with lots of facts. I learned some.
Well, I'm one of the executives for a college, and I am talking about this a fair amount on social media and podcasts because I really think we need to protect our seniors. It's not okay to get into that callous young Republican mode of let them die, they're the weak. But we also need to identify who is in that demographic. If I'm talking to anyone out there that's under 50, not immunosuppressed, if you're immunosuppressed, identify a couple close friends to talk to, stay home. But under 50, normally healthy, you're not gonna die, bro. Like, there's nothing that's going to happen to you. So keep that in mind. Keep that energy. Wear a mask and deliver groceries to your neighbors. Like, this sort of panic is unseemly, for want of a better word. There's nothing that's going to happen to most of you.
No, that's pretty good advice. Be smart about this. Make good choices. Wash your hands. But you should be doing that anyways. So, all right. Well, I think we'll end it here. You can check out Wilfred Riley at a couple places on Twitter. He's at will_duh_beast630. He also has several books, including Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About, and Hate Crime Hoax. He's wonderful. You could also check him on Facebook. He's great on both. I'm glad to have him on the podcast. Call him a friend. He's a great guy. Thank you for coming on and doing this fun episode.
Sure thing. Glad to be here.
Cool.
Thank you for listening. The Happy Warrior Podcast, hosted by Peter Vaughn Pischke, produced by Robert Mayling, a production of the Sioux Empire Podcast Network. Learn more at happy-warrior.net.
A production of the SiouxEmpire.com.